So it's June 4th, just 10 minutes before midnight. June 4th is the day on which the positions of the sun and earth are reversed to what they were on my birthday. I used to tell people way back in Santa Fe days that used to advise them to celebrate their Earth Day. Your Earth Day is 6 months opposite to your birthday. So today's my Earth Day, meaning that the Earth today is in the position where the sun was when I was born, close to the star Antares in the heart of the Scorpion. And the sun is in the position of the earth when I was born, which is to say, around 12 degrees of Gemini near Aldebaran in the eye of the bull. So today is my Earth Day. It's also coming up on the 6th, which is the anniversary of the death of my friend Jan Michel Kerouac, who died in 1996. You can be grateful to Jan for the inheritance from her that has allowed me to operate freely without concern for my survival. And I can assure you that I plowed a great deal of that inheritance into the material and circumstantial expenses to carry forth Planetary Tantra to develop the work in Gnostic visionary teaching, which I have achieved over these years now, since she died. And so this would be what? Going on 23 years now. So let's see, where was I? Where were we on this first day of the shift of Idris 2019? Well, I started out by going back to look into the Pokhara journal. That's quite an exotic little piece of writing. Actually, when I was in Pokhara, I wrote two documents. And I've been tempted to record the other document. In fact, I might do that just for the hell of it, just for the pleasure of it. So I wrote the Pokhara Journal, which is the exposition of the thoughts and terrors and mental confusion and anguish of someone from the future. And that's recorded in this journal, which I have right here. It has a gray plastic cover, and it says on the front of it, Quality, spelled with a K, and inside it are the handwritten pages, of which I quoted a little bit. I have clearly come to see how, in some way, I must come to be serious, and I know that I can only do this by being absolutely unserious, that is comical. I must be absolutely absurd. More correctly, and with more respect for myself, I should say, I must seize upon some aspect of complete absurdity, absolute and divine trickery, and I must use this absolute object as a tool with which I can disassimilate or disassemble and reconstruct the universe. I just opened that at random. I mean, you can see my state of mind was out there, far out, man, as we used to say back in the 60s. Anyway, an additional two. poker journal, which I preciously am setting aside here. I had this very bizarre event happen to me. Well, one thing that happened while, let me describe to you what happened in March of 1966 when I was in Pokhara. Just a couple of things. One thing that happened to me was that as soon as I got there, I went over to the lake and I didn't have any place to stay, but I noticed that there was a building in construction, a small house in construction close to the lake, and it was boarded up with plywood sheets, which were very easy to pry away. And so I snuckered myself away in this building, which turns out to be, as far as I understand, it was intended to be the tourist office for Pokhara. But it was under construction and it was nothing was happening there. So I broke into that place and I was staying in there, sleeping in there. And a couple of things that happened to me. One thing was that I was sitting on the porch of this place one day, and I noticed some young Nepalese boys come along and wander along the edge of the lake, looking across the lake to the hillsides, which were covered gloriously with rhododendrons in bloom. And then I noticed, when I looked closely, that there was a movement on the hillside opposite. And lo and behold, there were Nepalese girls collecting firewood among the vast array of mauve-colored rhododendron flowers. So on one side of the bank, there are the girls, Nepalese girls, collecting firewood, which they piled on their backs and carried on their backs in a kind of a sheath or a kind of a, what do you call it, that they put a baby in when someone carries a baby. Can't think of the word. A sling. They had a back sling. They piled the firewood into this as they moved among this vast display of blossoming rhododendrons. And then on my side of the lake, just in front of where I was sitting on the step of this building in construction, like a small adobe building, really, I saw the Nepalese boys, and they were doing their typical posture, which you see all over Asia, which is squatting. Everyone squats. That's how you sit. You squat. That's how you sit in Asia. It's the social convention for sitting. You don't have a chair. You don't sit on the ground. You squat. And they were squatting and looking across at the girls. And so I watched them. And then I heard noises and I heard sounds. And I looked at the girls. I looked at the boys in the foreground, the girls in the background. And immensity of the Himalayas from Annapurna to Machu Picchu looming over me toward the northwest, covered in snow like heavy cream. And said to myself, what's going on here? What's happening? And to my delight, I realized that they were singing to each other. So the boys who are in the foreground on my side of the lake would sing like a phrase, a lilting phrase of some folk song, I suppose. This in Nepalese, right? And then there would be a pause, and then the girls would sing back from the other side. I mean, can you imagine anything more delightful than that? That was one of my great moments. Another one was when I arrived, I flew in an airplane. I could remember seeing through the cracks in the fuselage of this airplane. Nepali Airlines from Kathmandu to Pokhara. I got out of the airport. I walked over and took refuge at the lake. And I had this place on my leg. I think it was on my left leg. I had this wound that I got way, way, way back when I was down at the tip of the Indian subcontinent at a place called Nagercoil, which means snake coil, coil of the Naga. I somehow bruised my leg and I had this place that wouldn't heal on my lower part of my inside of my ankle, above the ankle. And it really bothered me because when I was in Kathmandu, I went to a street doctor and he said, "Oh, this is really, really bad, you know. This could become gangrene, and you, if you don't get shots, if you don't get this and that, you know, you might have to have the lower part of your leg below your knee amputated," which is really good news to hear when you're like an 18, 19-year-old kid wandering around out of your fucking mind in the Himalayas without a cent to your name and, you know, nowhere to go and no place. The Son of Man hath no place to allay his head. And so I was pretty freaked out by that. So I got to Pokhara and hobbled over to the lake, and I was really scared. First night that I broke into this place, I was really scared. It was twilight. I knew that I could sleep inside there. I would be safe. And there were these very strange, turbulent winds blowing. And I asked, I saw some of the natives, and I said, "What are these turbulent winds blowing?" And they said, "Bahutavata, Bahutavata." I had absolutely no idea what that meant, but it sounded like avatar to me. I said, "What is a Bahutavatar?" Fuck knows, but it's scaring me. I'm scared, and I'm worried, and I'm alone. I have nobody to support me, and I think I'm going out of my mind in the Himalayas. And I went over to the lake, and I said, "I surrender. I just surrender. I can't handle it. I'm powerless." And I sat there with my leg in the lake, my leg in the water of the lake, Pewatal. And then I crawled back, hobbled back to my place. I broke in, squeezed behind the plywood, broke into this place, and I went to sleep. And when I wake up in the morning, there was nothing on my leg. Nothing. It was as if I had never had anything. Never had a bruise, never had a cut, never had a wound that was separating and going to gangrene. Never. It never happened. So I stayed there for about, a couple of weeks. And had some really, really, really bizarre experiences. And at one point, I woke up in the morning, and I felt compelled to do something very precise. I said, "Well, okay, I'm going over to the Tibetan village, the local village." Now, around Pokhara, there were two locations. There was the airport. Then there were three locations. There was the Nepalese village. There was the Tibetan village. And there was the Tibetan refugee camp. I went to all three. I went to the Tibetan refugee camp. That was quite a trip. But on this day, I woke up and I said, "I'm going to go into the Tibetan village, which is the Nepalese village that is dominated by Tibetans. And I'm going to buy a pencil and a notebook." And I woke up with this absolutely clear notion in my mind: "John, go buy a pencil and a notebook." So I go over there, and sure enough, you see in the doorway of the stores in the houses these Tibetan women with their black hair piled and parted in that certain way in the middle, which reminds me kind of a Bahopi hairstyle of women, and then their heavy jewelry, their black costumes, and they're all super elegant people. And I went into one little shop run by Tibetans, and I bought this notebook, which is called the Elephant Exercise Book. And this is also right here somewhere in the archives. The Elephant Exercise Book. And it's gray, recycled paper of poor quality, and it has lined paper, and it's for children to do exercises and dictations when they're in school. And I bought a pencil, one pencil. And I took my pencil, I went back there to my refuge, and I remember it was the nighttime. I had bought some candles. I lit some candles. I sat on the ground, or I laid down actually on the ground because there was no table. I took my pencil. I opened the elephant exercise book, and I wrote a story. Like dictation, like it came out of the ethers. Exactly like I was taking dictation. So I wrote in pencil in the elephant exercise book, and when I completed the story, there were probably like, 10 lines left in the elephant exercise book. It fitted it perfectly from the first page to the last, as if the elephant exercise book... Oh, Ganesh, please indulge me. The Elephant Exercise Book was custom designed to receive this story. And I've been tempted to read this story that I wrote. And I may do that, and I may record that sometime soon. But getting back to my personal reflections during the shift of May, what's really at the heart of it all? I'd like to talk to you about that. The Turton talking up close and personal, which is permissible at this point, certainly permissible, maybe even desirable. It's come to the point where the transcendental is for me the only aspect of the personal that I can even grasp. So there I was last night in my personal reality, down here in my den, where I work, where I have 4 Macs operating, 3 screens open, doing what it requires to pull Nemeta together. And Goddess knows what else, in the process of writing a book proposal as well. And I was just floating, taking a little break there for a moment. And I says to myself, or myself says to me, "Hey, John, who is actually your favorite French poet?" You know, people who know me know what my favorites are. Isn't that true? Don't you find that the people that you know and love deeply know what your favorites are, and you know theirs? Don't you think that the Aeonic Mother knows what your favorites are? Savor that one for a while, my friends. She knows, and she wants to know. I'm thinking, well, people who know John Lash pretty well would tell you who was his favorite painter at the beginning of the 20th century, with great reservations, nevertheless, with exceptions. But his favorite painter, his favorite Russian composer, things of that sort. So there's the Turton himself saying, "Well, hey, Turton, about time that you remembered who's your favorite French poet, because you do read French and you were fluent in it in your teen years. Of course, there is Celine, unquestionably the greatest French novelist of the 20th century, and of equal stature with a novelist in any other language, Voyage au bout de la nuit, Journey to the End of the Night. But what about poets? Well, I have to break it down a little bit there. Hold on here, folks. Let's say go back to the 19th century, and I would say Verlaine, Paul Verlaine, is my favorite French poet in the 19th century. And then when you come forward to the 20th century, it's a character called Jacques Prévert, P-R-E-V-E-R-T, Jacques Prévert. So I find myself here just about 24 hours ago, a little after midnight, which is a Miles Davis trope, thinking about Jacques Prévert. You know, in Verlaine, you might be surprised because you might have thought, well, Mallarmé. I bet you thought it was Mallarmé, didn't you? Ha, ha, ha. Caught you on that one. No, my favorite French poet is not Stéphane Mallarmé, who is an extremely complicated mythopoetic genius, but the more simple-minded Paul Verlaine. And then in the 20th century, this wonderful character, Jacques Prévert. You probably have never heard the name of Jacques Prévert, but you certainly heard the song Autumn Leaves, haven't you? You've heard the instrumental variations and you've heard the lyrics. Well, Jacques Prévert wrote, originally in French, the lyrics to Autumn Leaves. Now, I have something going about Autumn Leaves. It does something to me. It keys me to my destiny when I hear that song. And I think you might agree that there are two songs that actually are a French poetic derivation of, very few people may know that, which are hauntingly profound and beautiful in the romantic and lyric sense. And they are Autumn Leaves, based on a poem by Jacques Prévert, and Beyond the Sea, which is a song translated, sung by Bobby Darin, a song from a French singer called Trenet, Robert Trenet, I believe. And these two songs, La Mer, Beyond the Sea, and Autumn Leaves, Les Feuilles Mortes, are just imprinted profoundly in the musical consciousness of the human species, aren't they? So they refer me back to, you know, my early and adolescent involvement with French language and French literature. So I was listening to Yves Montand sing that poem of Jacques Prévert. I was sitting right over there, not in the corner of the studio where I'm sitting now. And I just totally, tenderly, unequivocally broke down. And I sat there with my face in my hands, just sobbing, sobbing, sobbing with tears. And what am I sobbing about? You know, what kind of sobbing is it? It's a mixture. It's an alchemical mixture of the distillations, of many, many distillations of grief and joy and astonishment. So I'm sitting there, my head in my hands. When I can finally pull myself back to the verbal level of some kind of self-articulation of my state of mind, what comes up? You know, a question comes out of the heart. It's like the nose of a little snail poking out of its shell. And this question comes to me from the depths of the heart, from the auricular, ventricular, nautilus of the nada sound in the heart. And the question is, just this, what happened to me? What happened to me? Oh my goddess, what happened to me? And I can only receive this question with the sobbing of the heart that gives me the question. So there I was, and having told you the question, this is the occasion, I guess, to tell you the answer. I want you all to know the answer. You know, what did happen to me? Well, that question hits me in a particular way with a triple impact. The most immediate impact goes to August of 2008, when I received the terma. What happened to me? I didn't see that coming. I mean, what happened to me after that? What happened to me? And the impact, as I feel the impact, goes deeper. It goes back in time to the age of 16 when I had that series of Kundalini experiences that went on for 6 months, completely devastated me and turned my life upside down, inside out. What happened to me? And then the impact goes to the third level, which is really the first iteration of all, the age of 4, and the dream, the lucid dream of the Dakini on the roof of that house in Friendship, Maine. And what happened to me? Oh my goddess. And when it hits me sometime, I swear, I have to tell you, I'm completely, completely obliterated by the realization of what has happened to me. And I'm telling you about it now because it's also happening to you. It's happening to you as well. You will recall, and I famously said regarding the terma, that the only thing I can tell you about my enlightenment is it's yours. This is the basis of everything going forward from this present moment in time. And it's only the present moment that you have. This is the basis of the Maitreya process. This is the basis of handover. This is the basis of passage of command. This is the basis of the shared. Application and actualization of planetary tantra. The only thing I can tell you about my enlightenment is this. It's yours. Enlightenment cannot be the experience of any single entity or person. Now, in Kali Yuga, it cannot be so. The rules are different. There are no rules. The game has changed. And the game of enlightenment is a game of pretenses. Whoever has the most transparent pretenses wins the game. So there I am in this room, this very room, 24 hours ago. Sobbing about what happened to me. And I can assure you, and certainly I don't need to assure you, but I can, that it's a really, really poignant event for me to have this happen when it does happen. And it happens occasionally. And who knows? It may even happen more frequently soon. I can't say, but I wonder. And also wonder if you're beginning to know, if you're beginning to realize that everything that happened to me is happening to you as well. You see, this planetary tantra, this terma of Gaia awakening is unlike anything that ever happened before. And how so? It is unlike anything that ever happened before in the sense that it's happening to a single person makes it happen to everyone who connects to that person. Should they be disposed to that experience? Should you be disposed? It's happening to you through me. What appears to be through me is identical with it happening to you directly without me. You see, you may think up until this point, you may suppose, my dear friends and allies, that I transmit planetary tantra to you. But that is not, in fact, the case at all. You may suppose that, oh, the Nahual of Infinity Ridge, you know, John Lash, the main Turton, and all his other titles, he's the one who initiated all this. And in a sense that is true, but in another sense it's not true. It's not the totality of the truth. My initiation of planetary tantra and the terma of Gaia awakening is just a pretext for her to give it to you directly. A pretext. I'm just a fucking pretext for her to give it to you directly. So that's what I mean when I say, sopping with my head in my hands, what happened to me is happening to you as well. And that is how it happens. That is how this great event, Terma of Gaia Awakening and Sophia's Correction, happens. You can realize for yourself, really, I intend you to know how simple and direct this is. You can realize for yourself the nature of this terma of Gaia awakening, is ultimate primacy, ultimate primary realization. Your realization of the term of Gaia awakening is not subsequent to mine or dependent upon mine. It only comes as a primary awakening to everyone. It appears that it is I, this man, the kid from coastal Maine, grown into the man of the future, who comes now into the present. It appears that it is he who gives you this realization. But in fact, she gives it to you directly, and I am just a pretext for her to do that. So there you go. You get a sense of some of my reflections during the shift of May 2019. And there's so much more. There's so much more that I can say. What do I want to say now? Last half hour of this second part. What would I like to say, John? What would you like to say in a personal and transpersonal vein? Well, I guess I could summarize it in this way. You know, I've come to two realizations, two resounding insights through the previous shift. First one concerns my, how should I put this? First realization that comes to me is something I've never been able to see before about my own destiny as a man. And I'm talking now as a man. What kind of a man am I? I'm a complicated man, I can assure you of that. But I'm not complicated by intention or due to the wish to be complicated. I'm complicated by the impact of supernatural intercessions that have been executed upon me. And I had the great pleasure and privilege, which I continue to pursue during the last shift, to form a picture of what my life would have been like had these intercessions not occurred. Let's take a moment. Just pause for a moment. Sit back and reflect on what I just said. I've had the occasion in the shift to see, it has been shown to me, you could say, by the grace of the goddess herself, the life that I would have lived had not certain exceptional forces been exerted upon me. You know, I have a supernatural condition. Starting from the age of 4. And I also have a neurological condition that probably kicked in after that Kundalini experience. I'm still putting it together. Kundalini experience at the age of 16, October 61, I believe it was really decisive in putting me on the course to be Nahual and to be the Turton. Certainly, I'm still looking at how certain developments occurred. And I have to say that I'm really moved and changed by this shift that's just completed. It's shown me so much about myself that I've never seen before. I can actually see what life I would have lived and what kind of man I would have been had I not been taken on the path of the supernatural and the Nahual that led me to planetary Tantra and the Terma of Gaia awakening. And this is it's a remarkable experience for me. I'm immersed in it. I'm still immersed in it right now as I'm talking about it. And I'm disclosing what transpires in me as I consider that actual man. You know, that actual man I would have been were I not this extraordinary and bizarre creature that I turned out to be. That actual man has actually haunted me all my life. That man has haunted me. What? How can I give you a picture or a sense of what that man would have been like? Well, go look up John Derek, D-E-R-E-K. I would have been someone like John Derek. And as the Wikipedia entry says, quote, Derek disliked acting, end quote. So John Derek was a big mover and shaker in Hollywood, but non-Zenosh, totally non-Zenosh, born in 1926, died in 1998, was an American director of films and photographer. I would have been John Lash, something like John Derek. And you know, it's such a fabulous revelation for me to know this. I mean, I don't know what you're making of this. You think, well, these guys gone off into fantasy zone. I mean, what on earth are you talking about? But I know you'll get it. I just know you will, because it's so palpable. You can taste it on your tongue. You know, I wrote Sabina, my first screenplay, in 3 weeks up in Belgium in the loft. I wrote this screenplay for Dr. Sachs, based on the novel by Jack Kerouac, in May of 2010, 3 weeks again. In fact, we finished it on June 6th, the anniversary of Jan's death. I remember very well, because Jan figures strongly in the scenario, the film scenario based on Dr. Sachs, of her father, Jack Kerouac. So I wrote that 10 fucking years ago in Andalusia. And I've also written the draft or the full treatment for American Grail, which is the retelling of the story of Parsifal derived from Wolfram von Eschenbach, but converted into a cowboy and Indian story set in America in the 1880s. Plus, I've written the opening sequences for Lydia's Vow. So these are my screenplays. I will never live to see these screenplays realized, but you may. And even if you do not, you may position others who do live to see these screenplays realized. Something that I've come to see in this last month is that the goddess in her benevolence wants to see these works achieved in the world in honor of her Turton, you could say. Or just because it's great stuff that needs to get out there, you could say. Never, never, never let it cross your mind that I sacrificed anything to be who I am today. But be clear on one thing, and this is the most intimate personal disclosure I will ever give you. The alpha man, who was like John Derrick, had to defer to the beta man for all this to come about, as it has. My life as an alpha man and my life as a beta man are intermingled like the threads of destiny and fate are intermingled. I've come to realize this. Honestly, I have. It's fucking unbelievably wonderful and strange that I have come to realize this at this point in my life. And I guess it must be part of the healing process. It must be part of this cure, which is a cure I undertake. And it is not the cure I shall undertake, as you shall as well. But in this cure, I've come to realize that there was no sacrifice involved. And yet, I had the option of another life. And that option has haunted me so much. I would have become an independent filmmaker. That's why I have this thing about film. Can you see that? It's the hangover from that. I'm hungover about my destiny as a filmmaker. But I'm totally and absolutely 1,000% immersed in my fate. As the Turton of the Terma of Gaia Awakening. And that's how I sum up my life for you right now. How I sum it up for myself. And this is what I've been going through in the previous shift. So I made the option to indulge myself and stick with it. But I'm reporting to you now. And you get the point, don't you? If you realize, if you can allow yourself to accept the nature of this enlightenment, then you know that I am a man who was derailed from one destiny to bring to you the fate of correction, which is the fate of the entire human species. It's the benign and benevolent fate of the entire human species. And John Lash is the proxy of that fate that shows you that it's your fate. if you choose to accept him. I've said so many times, and I must continue to say, that correction is optional and elective. Remember that the themes I stated for the Tara Budavi shift of 2019 were correction and selection. So there you go. I really need to supplement and complete those notes by going directly into some of the issues of correction and selection, which have to do with sexual pleasure, sexual mores, death, euthanasia, and issues of that kind. What's happening to me right now, and I do mean right now, as I'm speaking these words, recording them, what's happening is a building momentum that comes from the reflections of this previous shift. I don't know, who knows? None of this has ever happened before. You know, there's a line in the Matrix film, which is crap, by the way. I watched it the other day. Basically crap. But there are a few brilliant lines in it. One of the brilliant lines is when Trinity asks Neo, well, how do you know it will work? And he says, well, it's never been done before. So there you have it. How banal can you get? Quotation from the Matrix. And yet it's true for Planetary Tantra. It's true for everything I do and say, and everything I pass on to you, hand on to you, by passage of command. To use the technical jargon of Planetary Tantra. Okay. So how can I wind up here? In this small episode of personal, transpersonal disclosure. Well, let's go back to the opening sequence. Those passages from the journal, so-called journal I wrote in Pokhara, Nepal, in March of 1966. Well, I guess I could say, with some sense of relief, that the man who came from the future is synchronizing with the man in the present. This being so, you can see how I would be undergoing these reflections about my other life, as you might call it, my alpha male life. By the way, I just want to say, by way of a brief explanation, that when I refer to the alpha male, deferring to the beta male, I'm simply describing two selves, two interacting selves, selves, two interacting aspects of myself. And although I won't elaborate here and now on this particular characterization, it would be good for you to know what I mean by beta male. Why would I choose to shift from the default position of alpha male, take an alpha male like John Derek, and what he can command, to the seemingly inferior position of a beta male. Why would I take that option? Well, it wasn't exactly an option. To know a little bit, to have just a preview of what I mean by beta male, I'll put it to you in the form of a riddle. What kind of hamburger do you get made from rump steak? Question mark. So here we are, here I am, concluding the second part of this talk. And the happy news I have to announce is that in certain ways, that alpha male is coming to the fore. So it's through the alpha male aspect of my personality that I would express, I would be able to express, I would be disposed to express, and I desire to express my views on certain matters. In a way that an alpha male would express his views, regardless of any occult or esoteric considerations. I might be coming to that, and that might be part of my cure. Now I'll continue, of course, to express myself in the range of occult considerations based on the Gnostic intelligence that I command, and that is formidable. I don't say so arrogantly. It's just my inheritance. It's my endowment. It comes to me through the Terma of Gaia awakening. What happened to me? When I received the Terma of Gaia awakening, do you know that you haven't even begun to see half of what came through the Terma of Gaia awakening? There are not only the essential elements of the Terma, such as the three instructions of the Diamond Sky Dakinis, the Gaian Tantric vow with the ritual of iron bonding, and the Dakini name for invocation of the Aeonic Mother. I mean, that is the quintessential simplicity of the Terma of Gaia Awakening. But when I received the Terma of Gaia Awakening, hold on. It was as if the goddess comes to you and she says, here is this crystalline intelligence regarding the method of interactivity and communication with me. There you have it. And now let me show you the bonus accessories. Right? Like the Kali Dice Oracle, like the Shakti Cluster Divination Deck, which is an upgrade of the Tarot based in the framework of Planetary Tantra, which is like, I don't know, where do I start? You know, Kalika sex magic, have you ever heard of that? Kala Tantra, you know, the module of Kala Tantra, the three instructions of the Diamond Sky Dakinis concerning Kala Tantra, the Panchamakara and the Panchatattva, the 2 5-point rituals of Kala Tantra. Do you know anything about that? And all of the accoutrements and all of the aspects and accessories of the mantik of planetary tantra is just packaging of the terma. Do you realize that? It's just the packaging of the terma. The terma is a tray. Go look at it. Go listen to it. I haven't even begun to talk about Kala Tantra, have I? You know, there was a time in, I don't know, I guess 2009, 2010, when I said to myself, Sean, just write down on a piece of parchment in flowing ink the three instructions of Kala Tantra and the essential elements of the two rituals, five-point rituals of the Panchamakara and the Panchatatra, which are performed by touching the body, and add the appropriate symbols and sigils and roll it up and put it in a copper tube and seal it at both ends with cork and seal that with wax and go up on Infinity Ridge and tie it somewhere to a tree and hide it for someone to find in the future. That is the way that termas are often said to be hidden away to be discovered in the future. But the future is now. It's the future now. The man from the future has caught up with the future in the present. The future is now. So now's the time when I can talk about these things. And I've been tempted to talk about Kalika sex magic. I've been tempted to present an 8-part course on it in the form of spoken talks and a handbook. And believe me, that would be very expensive. And I might release that if it's my pleasure to do so. You know, everything that I experience as a Turton happens at my pleasure as well as her pleasure. So it's not just my pleasure alone, but it's when her pleasure and my pleasure coincide that the moment presents itself when I can do these things, and those moments come and they go. So there's a lot you haven't got yet. And that's all due to what happened to me. What happened to me for 8 months from August 2008, 8 months of outrageous mania, trying to face what was pouring into me and through me, trying to face and hold the power of that abundance, of that awesome abundance of her wisdom and generosity. The generosity of an aeon is the love of an aeon. There is no distinction for the aeon or with the aeon between love and generosity. I don't speak of the love of the aeon Sophia. I will speak of it. Ask me to. I'll tell you all about it. I'll tell you what it is. What it is to be the object of that love. Not that you don't know already, but you would enjoy hearing it from me from time to time, I imagine. Just remember, concerning yours truly, that I never, ever consider that my enlightenment exceeds yours in any way, by any measure, but the measure of my enlightenment is precisely that I do not make that presumption. Oh, so On that happy note, I'm going to conclude this talk, the second part of this presentation at the beginning of the Idris shift, looking back to the previous shift. And how can I wind it up? Well, I'd like you to be on the same page as myself. This is a talk to staff of Nemata, your staff. Do you know what that means? It means you're student teachers. You're not ever just in the passive role of receiving, but you're in the line of transmission. So now you're getting core intel from the source of transmission. The Tao can be transmitted, but it cannot be received. That's a quote from a Chinese mystic of the 5th century, Chuang Tzu. And yet there is transmission. And I guess what I'd like to say in closing is that my style of delivery of transmission as a Tertan is one thing. And my style of delivery as an alpha male is something else again. So here I am, the man from the future, landing in the present, and I have some things to say about issues of today concerning sexual mores, particularly concerning hot-button topics like birth control, like euthanasia, transsexualism. And what I have to say about some of these matters is not just my opinion, but of course it comes across that way. You know, here I am, John Lash, the Gnostic teacher, and he has his personal opinions on this, that, and the other. For instance, sexual behavior, sexual mores. Okay, so they're my personal opinions. They shall be recorded as my personal opinions. I don't claim that they come from some elevated status that I enjoy due to being an accomplished shaman, a siddha, and a Tertan. Blow it all out your R's, you know? Who cares about any of that? When it comes to the man speaking, the man shall speak. Don't forget the riddle. Don't overlook the riddle. What do you get when you make hamburgers out of rump steak? You need to know that. So I'm playing with you on that one. And as for what's coming next, well, I don't know what to say. I can't even begin to speculate. We're all like kids with our nose to the windshield on a racing bobsled that's going 150 miles an hour down a very steep field in Vermont. I mean, really, kids with nose to the windshield. That's where we are today. I will, of course, continue to provide the parameters of celestial intel on the current apogee and perigee hits, especially the two hits of the lunar perigee at the Dhumavati points, 16 and 17 Leo, in the region between the crab and the lion. And I'll continue to report on the Jupiter loop and the Saturn loop and the extraordinary eclipses due to come in the stall of the lunar apogee and the Manitou and anything else that might strike my fancy so that I can strike yours. It's all for our delightment, if I might coin a phrase. It's all happening for our delightment. And sharing it, such joy, and the synergy and power of sharing is immense. To recognize and to enhance that synergy was the intention of the courting that I did at the end of the last shift. So there you have it. That is all I can say and care to say at the moment. You may recall from the GNE that the slurring of the S's, remember the slurring of the S's? You hear it in the speech of Rajneesh. Why does he slur his S's? That's to speak as a serpent speaks. Gnostics slurred their S's when they gave discourses to students outside of the mystery cells. You know, when they talked amongst each other in the mystery cells, in a state of high trance, they didn't slur. But on those occasions when they brought DI downloads directly from the interior of the mystery cell out into external discourse, they slurred their S's. They hissed. Now, it's possible that Rajneesh slurred his S's and hesitated on the S sound due to the ingestion of what? Nitrous oxide, you know, laughing gas. Great subject, laughing gas. Go read The Varieties of Religious Experience by William James. A good part of it is dedicated to discussion of the experiences undergone with nitrous oxide. It so happens, nitrous oxide, which is a derivative of nitrogen, refers to that Dakini instruction. How so? Because 80% or better of the atmosphere you breathe, including oxygen, it's nitrogen. You breathe nitrogen. It's intoxicating to breathe nitrogen. But what conditions does it take to reveal that intoxication? So I said in those GNE talks where I alluded to that odd phenomenon of the serpent hiss, I said that, what did I say? No, I said that it's characteristic of someone who speaks from the black diamond vehicle, which is like a luge sled that you sit on backwards. Yeah, I did say that at one time, at one moment. Among many things I've said in the course of this great and glorious, glorious adventure.